Pull up a chair. I want to take you to a big, quiet room in Dayton, Ohio. The National Museum of the United States Air Force. It's early, before the school groups arrive, and the light is coming down soft on a whole gallery of World War II iron. And there she is, olive drab on top, gray on the belly and painted on the nose, a long-legged girl in a blue bathing suit. Below her, in script, a name that just about every pilot in America knows, even if they've never worn a uniform. Memphis Belle, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today, we're not talking about a fight in the sky, we're talking about an airplane that survived one and then almost didn't survive peacetime, and the people who wouldn't let her rot. Let me set the scene for you first, because to understand why the Belle matters, you've got to understand the arithmetic. 1942, 1943. The 8th Air Force is flying out of England, daylight bombing raids deep into occupied Europe and into Germany itself. High altitude. No fighter escort that can go the whole distance, not yet. And the airplane doing the heavy lifting is the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. Now, the Fortress was a beautiful piece of engineering. Four Wright Cyclone engines, a wingspan of about 103 feet, 1350 caliber machine guns bristling out of her by the later models. She could take punishment that would fold a lesser airplane. Guys came home with whole sections of tail shot away, engines feathered and dead, holes you could throw a dog through, and that airplane kept flying. But here's the number that mattered to the men who flew her. A cruise combat tour was 25 missions, fly 25, and you could go home, and in that first year, the loss rates over Europe were so bad that finishing 25 was statistically close to impossible. On some raids, the 8th was losing airplanes by the dozen. Do the math on a 5% loss rate over 25 trips, and you'll understand why the men didn't talk about it much. A young co-pilot could look down a mess hall table and know, without saying a word, that most of those faces would not be there. In the spring now, here's where it gets interesting. Before we go on, let me tell you who's making today's show possible. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every coin tells a story. That's the whole idea, isn't it? A thing you can hold in your hand that says, I was there, I did that. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, back to England. The Memphis Belle was a B-17F model built by Boeing out in Seattle, and she went to war with the 91st Bomb Group at a field called Bassingbourne. Her pilot was a young man from Wisconsin named Robert Morgan, and the name on her nose, the girl in the blue bathing suit that came from Morgan's sweetheart back in Memphis, Tennessee, a young woman named Margaret Polk. The artwork itself was copied from a magazine pinup by an artist named George Petty. Morgan wanted his girl on the airplane, and he got her. Now picture what a mission actually was, and I mean really picture it, because the movies clean it up. You're up at 25,000 feet, there is no pressurization in a B-17, the cabin is the sky. It is 50, 60 degrees below zero inside that airplane, cold enough that if you touched bare metal with a bare hand, your skin froze to it. The men wore electrically heated suits that shorted out and quit. Frostbite put more men in the hospital on some raids than flak did. You're breathing through an oxygen mask, and if the line kinks or freezes, you've got a couple of minutes of good judgment left before you pass out and never wake up, and the man next to you has to notice in time. And the noise, four cyclones at cruise power unmuffled, right there with you, hour after hour, a B-17 crewman came home with his ears ringing for days. The waist gunners stood at open windows in that hurricane of freezing air. And when the guns fired, the whole airframe shuddered and the spent brass rang and rolled across the aluminum floor. Then the flak comes up, black puffs, and you can smell it when it's close, a sharp burnt cordite stink that got in through the airframe. You can't dodge it. The bomb run is straight and level and you hold it, because the bombardier has the airplane now, hunched over his Norden sight, and your whole job for those long minutes is to fly a perfectly steady line, while men below you do their level best to kill you. And then the fighters. Messerschmitts and Focke Wulfs coming in head-on, closing at a combined speed that gave the gunners a heartbeat to fire. The Memphis Belle and her crew flew into that 25 times. Different targets. Submarine pens at Lorient and Brest and Saint-Nazaire, which the crews grimly called Flak City, rallyards. The city of Wilhelmshaven, they flew, and they came back, and they flew again. She took battle damage. They swapped out engines, patched holes, replaced control surfaces, wore out, and changed I don't know how many tires and props over those months. The airplane you see in Dayton is a survivor in the truest sense. She was worked hard and hurt and fixed and sent up again. And on the 17th of May 1943, over Lorient, the Memphis Belle and her crew completed mission number 2525. Now the Army Air Forces understood something about morale and about the folks back home. Here was a crew that had beaten the odds. all of them alive, whole, tour complete. That was a story America needed in 1943. So the Belle and most of her crew were pulled off combat and sent home on a war bond tour, 30-some cities, handshakes and factory floors and speeches showing the workers building these airplanes what their work was for. And there was a film, a young Hollywood director named William Wyler, a serious filmmaker, went to England and flew on actual combat missions with a color camera to shoot it. Men died shooting that footage. One of Wyler's cameramen was killed in the air. What came out of it in 1944 was a documentary called Memphis Belle, and it put the American public inside that freezing, roaring, terrifying airplane like nothing before it. That film is a big part of why this one airplane, out of the thousands of fortresses built, became the one everybody remembers.
Here's a thing that surprises people, though. She probably wasn't actually the first. For years, the Belle was billed as the first 8th Air Force heavy bomber to finish 25 missions and bring her crew home. The truth, dug out later by historians, is that another fortress, one called Hell's Angels, likely hit 25 a few days ahead of her, and there were other contenders too. But the Belle had the girl on the nose and the pilot's sweetheart and William Wyler's camera. She had the story, and sometimes the story is what flies down through the years. So what happens to a famous airplane when the war ends? This is the part that ought to make every one of us who loves old iron sit up. Almost nothing good, after the bond tour, the Belle bounced around. Training duty. Then when the war was over, she got flown out to the boneyard, to a field in the Arizona desert with thousands of other warbirds all lined up waiting for the smelter. That was the fate of nearly all of them. The greatest air armada the world had ever built was cut up for pots and pans and beer cans. It happened fast, and it happened to airplanes far more historic than most people realize. The Memphis Belle came within a whisker of that. She was on the list, scrap, and the city of Memphis, Tennessee, stepped in and bought her. Paid a few $100s for her, if you can believe it, and brought her home to the city whose name she wore. Which sounds like a happy ending. It wasn't, not yet, because a B-17 is a big airplane and a city doesn't have a hangar just sitting empty. For decades, the Belle sat outdoors, out in the Memphis weather. Rain, sun, humidity, ice, and people. God love us, people are hard on things. Souvenir hunters climbed all over her. They pulled off pieces, they cut swatches out of her skin. Somebody made off with instruments, with guns, with 100 little parts. Birds got in, water got in, aluminum corrodes, wood rots, and the girl on the nose faded out in the sun.
She sat outside, more or less, for the better part of 50 years, on a pole for a while. Under an open-sided pavilion for a while. A national treasure, slowly going to powder because nobody quite had the money or the roof to save her properly. Now here's where it gets interesting, and here's where it turns. In 2005, the United States Air Force stepped in. The National Museum of the United States Air Force up in Dayton took ownership of the Memphis Belle and trucked her north. And the restoration crew up there, those are some of the finest airplane people on the planet. They opened her up and got a good hard look at what 50 years outdoors had done. It was bad. They found corrosion deep in the structure. They found parts missing, parts wrong, parts that had been swapped in over the years that never belonged on her. And they made a decision that I want you to really hear because it tells you what kind of people restore airplanes for the right reasons. They decided to do it right, no matter how long it took, and it took 13 years. 13 years. Not because anybody was slow, because doing it right is slow. They researched what every single piece was supposed to be, down to the placards and the wiring, and the exact shade of paint, and the exact rendering of that girl on the nose. They tracked down correct parts, they fabricated what they couldn't find, using original methods and original drawings where they could get them. They chased corrosion out of the bones of her, one rivet, one panel, one longer on at a time. If you've ever restored anything, even a cub, even a car, you know this feeling. You start out thinking you'll clean her up, and it turns into pulling the whole thing apart to the frame, because you can't unsee what you've seen. Now imagine that on a 4-engine heavy bomber, that's a genuine piece of national history, where you cannot just fudge it and move on. Every choice matters. Every choice is going to sit under museum lights for the next 100 years with a little sign next to it. Those folks in Dayton did it. Volunteers and staff, thousands and thousands of hours. And on the 17th of May, 2018, they rolled her out.
The 17th of May, same date 75 years to the day after the crew flew that 25th mission over L'Orient in 1943. That wasn't an accident. Somebody planned that, and I love them for it. And now she hangs, or rather she stands, in that World War II gallery in Dayton, restored to exactly how she looked in the spring of 1943. The blue-suited girl bright on the nose again. The mission bombs painted on her flank, one for each trip. Every gun in place, every panel, true. You can walk right up to her. It's free to get in, by the way. That museum never charges a dime, which is the way it ought to be. You can stand under that wing and look up at all 13 guns and try, just try, to put yourself up at 25,000 feet in the cold and the noise, with the flak coming up on the bomb run, holding steady.
I'll tell you what gets me. It isn't the airplane, exactly, it's the young men. Morgan and his crew, kids, most of them early 20s, some of them teenagers, doing arithmetic in their heads that told them they probably weren't coming home and getting in that airplane anyway. 25 times, and then a whole other set of people, half a century later, who looked at a corroded, vandalized wreck on a pole and said, "No, we are not going to let this one be forgotten. We're going to spend 13 years and do it right." Airplanes don't save themselves. History doesn't save itself. It gets saved by people who care more about getting it right than about getting it done fast. Back when AVGs was cheap and airspace was free, we lost a lot of history to the smelter because nobody stopped to think what it would be worth. The Memphis Belle is what it looks like when somebody stops in time. If you're ever anywhere near Dayton, Ohio, you go see her. Give yourself a whole day, because that museum will swallow a day whole and ask for another. But go stand in front of the Belle first, say thank you to the crew and to the folks with the rivet guns who brought her back. My thanks today to the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton for the restoration record and the history, to Boeing for the airframe that started it all, and to William Wyler, whose camera in 1943 is a big reason we remember her name at all. You can find us anytime at radiohanger.com. This is Taildragger. Keep the blue side up and go look at something old and beautiful this week. It'll do you good.